Welcome everyone back to another episode of the Icelandic Roots podcast. Today we're in for a very special treat for a conversation with Hjördís Hilmarsdóttir, who is a local guide and expert in East Iceland. So we start this conversation out by talking about some of the nature and places in Eastern Iceland that Hjördís was an in-person tour guide of sorts, local expert for our group of Icelandic Roots volunteers that was traveling all around Iceland and spent time in East Iceland last year for the 10th anniversary of the Icelandic Roots organization. But getting more into Hjördís's inspiration, talk about her work documenting hiking trails and natural areas around East Iceland, as well as her Siberian Husky dogs, which are some of the only sled dogs in all of Iceland. In our conversation, we also delve into Hjördís's interest in the stories of the East Iceland abandoned farms, which are areas that people left during the Askja eruptions and around the North American emigration years. And we discuss the impact that her documentary has had, which you may already be familiar with, Hjördís, as the person behind the very popular Abandoned Farms of the East Iceland, Highland Farms, which is a documentary on the Icelandic Roots YouTube channel. Would highly recommend spending some time and watching that as well. So you're in for a great podcast. I hope you enjoy, and thank you for tuning in. Okay, hello, Hjördís. Thank you very much for agreeing to do the podcast here with me. How are you, and how's the weather where you are?
Thank you for having me. I'm fine, but the weather is bad.
Yes, so you are near Egilsstaðir, and I got a chance to meet you in person when you were our sort of tour guide for a couple of days when we were traveling in East Iceland last year for the Icelandic Roots trip.
Yeah.
And so in preparing for this conversation, I was kind of just thinking back to that trip. I'd never been to East Iceland before. When I was in Iceland the year before, I was there for the Snorri program, and we mainly stayed around Reykjavik. And then my homestay was near Kvasfatlar, kind of by Selfoss in that area. And when we traveled around, we just took kind of the west and north route, went up to Hofsós and then back down. So for me to come to East Iceland, and we did all the way down and around up to Vapnafjörður and then over to Akureyri that way. And I was just so impressed by the landscapes there and the nature. We also really had nice weather for our days there. It was so sunny and warm and incredible. And so I was really just mesmerized by that. So I wonder if there's anything you could say just towards the nature and the landscapes there, and maybe a bit into the conversation, we could tie into some of the work you've done with the hiking guides and that sort of thing. But maybe for a question I could ask you is, what's your favorite thing about the nature and the landscape in the area where you live?
All the mountains. I love hiking. We have a lot of mountains here. Oh, it's 1,000 meters high, and I love that.
Yeah, I seem to remember, too, from a geology perspective, the mountains are a bit different in the east. Like, they're older. They were maybe formed at an earlier time. But even just looking at them, they did seem a bit different than the mountain areas in the west or around the capital.
In Vestfjord and the Eastfjord, they are older. The land is older there. Of course, we have a lot of mountains all everywhere in Iceland, but I have from my window, I can see seven mountains over 1,000. So that's nice. But I like to hike easy hikes also. As I grow older, that's better for me.
Yes, well, there's definitely lots of options. Are you originally from this area?
No, I'm born in Reykjavik.
Okay.
But I lived here for 4 years, 1983 to 1987. And then my oldest was in school here and made a lot of friends. And when he had finished university, he's a lawyer and a real estate seller also. And then he moved back. And he had been asking me, I moved back 1987, and he had been asking me for many years to come and work for him. So I moved here again 2003.
And this is, if I remember correctly, I think you pointed out when we were on the bus tour, you're kind of a farm just outside of Egilsstaðir.
Yes, it's 17 kilometers from Egilsstaðir on the way to Hallormsstaðir. So I live alone on this farm with a stock.
Yes, well, there you go. I maybe was going to ask you later on, but why don't you talk about your dogs here now then?
I fell in love with Siberian Huskies 2003. And I had sled dogs are not common in our culture. Many people they think that it's like in Greenland, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The first Siberian Husky, he came here 2002.
Hmm.
In 2003, I got my first one.
Wow. Okay.
And I had 18 litters, and I've been breeding, but I've stopped breeding there almost 5 years ago. So now I only have my six dogs at home, and my son has 45. He's with dog sledding tours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So but mine are getting older, and but I still go on sleds. I love, that's almost the most, my favorite thing to do is dog sledding.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I've never done that before. And you're right. It is something that maybe if people don't actually know about Iceland, they may just assume that dog sledding and that sort of thing is part of the culture. But like you said, it's a recent thing. And maybe are you guys some of the few that actually do dog sledding then?
No, there are four firms. Four companies that have this for living.
Hmm.
But we have our sled dog club, and we have our Icelandic champion.
Wow.
I've been competing there.
Mm-hmm.
I did it last year. I was the far oldest competitor, but I did good.
That's very cool. How long would can you go with these dog sleds sometimes?
I don't go long. As you ask, my son, he phoned me this morning and he was inviting me on a long trip.
Wow.
Dog sledding trip next weekend, if the weather will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
He's been talking about this for 2-3 years to do that.
And where is that?
It's in the north between here and Akureyri.
Okay.
Near Mývatn.
Yeah, that's another really beautiful area. And again, went there for the first time on the trip last year. It was really just so incredible to experience all of those different places. And I could imagine going around in those areas on a dog sled would be really quite cool and just a neat way to experience it.
Yeah.
Now, I think I remember too, I might have asked you this on the trip, but I was so interested. Well, first of all, just the wildlife in Iceland, you know, it's there's a lot, but it's rather small compared to some places, maybe.
Yeah.
So, you know, certainly the bird life, there's lots of different types of birds. But in terms of mammals, there's not too many. And so I was lucky to see some Arctic foxes here and there and these sorts of things. But I knew when I was going out to the east that, oh, I could maybe potentially see some reindeer. But during that time of year in September, I was told that maybe I wouldn't get so lucky. They're more kind of in the highlands and grazing. And I think I asked you this during the trip, but I'll ask you here again and for our audience to listen in. How often do you see reindeer, and is it a common occurrence?
It depends on the weather and all that. But sometimes I have 50 to 70 reindeers on my land.
Wow.
Yeah, and so Some winters it has been like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different. They are not always on the same places, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I love when they are here. Once there was one big male. He was here the whole summer.
Wow.
And he got to know us, you know. And he was not afraid with us. So I was so sorry when they shut him. I'm sure they shut him because they got a big one near my land. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that could be tough, but that is one of the things from what I understand, right? Of course, there's no wolves or large predators that can, you know, keep the reindeer populations in check. And, you know, if people aren't familiar, they aren't originally native there and they were introduced to Iceland. And so without hunters, those populations might not be be stable. So,
but they were imported in Iceland. I think it was 1600 or something, or 1700. I'm not quite sure, but many years ago. And they were few places around Iceland, but they're only in the east now.
Yeah, and maybe better for seeing them in the winter, potentially.
Yeah, but also in spring you can see them. Rather seldom in the autumn or summer. Except if you go in the wilderness, you know.
So when did you start making these sort of guides for hiking? And what do you do with that work?
When I moved here, I started to hike late. I started to hike after I was 40, or I think I was 45 when I got my first hiking shoes. So, and when we moved here, I started to be a volunteer with the touring club,
mm-hmm.
and was in a committee that decided the trips with the touring club takes every year. And me and my friend, we thought we should make something that would get people out, the families. You know, we were not thinking of tourists then.
Right.
They were just thinking of families out to hike.
Hmm.
So we chose 18 places here in Fljótsdalshérað, you know, where I live, around that. One easy and one in each this. I don't remember what Hreppur is. You know, it's a part of, the place. A community, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there were nine communities in which are now two. You know, they've united.
Mm-hmm.
So we started to choose one difficult and one easy hike in each community, and we made a brochure and we went to these places with information which we put in a. Like a box or something, and there was a stamp, so people could buy a paper to stamp in, and collect some stamps, and then it was a lottery each autumn. You know?
Interesting.
Yeah, so it went very well, so because it did so well. The hiking pearls that did so well. We decided to do it also about the Highland farms. Hike between the farms and get some information in this box and stuff. So later on, people, the tourists was increasing in the east, and they said it was such a good project, you know, I should do it more for the tourist.
Yes.
more photos and all that.
Mm.
So that's why I started to do these ones. And there are 30 pearls now, which people can hike. And there's also an app where you can follow to all the pearls. Yeah. So, yeah, I've done a lot about it. And also, when you start, there are some big signs that tell you about it. When you start hiking, yeah. So, yeah, that's I've been doing this for several years.
Yeah, that's very cool. And were these hikes, were some of these trails already established, or were these ones that you guys were kind of just creating?
Yeah, both.
Okay.
Because I used the people that had lived here all their lives and asked them to choose these places with me. Of course, some waterfalls everyone knew, you know, or some mountains everyone knew. But there are some places we have introduced to people. People here, they didn't know this place. It's one of the most beautiful places in the East Iceland. So this is by the sea, and it's rather difficult to go there. It's an old harbor there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is the most, I think this is most interesting of all these hikes.
Okay, what's the name again?
Name is Þerribjarg.
Okay.
It's a difficult name. It's a, like dry rock, something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, again, I was just so struck by the nature out there and just, yeah, maybe, I don't know. It was really nice weather when we went there, but everything just felt so absolutely beautiful and so vast. And I remember, well, unfortunately, since we were on the tour, we didn't really have time to do any of these hikes and we were going from place to place. But I do remember, I think we drove past, was it Hengifoss?
Yes.
The really tall waterfall. And so I at least could see that from the bus.
Yes. It's the second highest waterfall in Iceland.
Wow.
We have a lot of beautiful waterfalls in Iceland.
Yes, no, certainly. And I imagine that one there, and just in general, the hiking areas in the east are still not quite as busy, which is probably a good thing, you know, a bit more calm and quiet and not crazy with tourists.
We can stay. Hengifoss is always crowded, always. It's always someone there. In the winters also, but there are many beautiful places where you can hike and you don't meet anyone on the way. I love that.
Yes, no, it's very special and different too. I often mention this, like for me growing up here in Alberta, you know, there's really beautiful mountains and lots of hikes, but it is something that you're always alert and aware of wildlife, and especially bears can be quite dangerous. But, you know, even cougars, more rare to encounter, and wolves too. There's lots of different wildlife that you always have to kind of be aware of. And I really noticed when I was going on hikes in Iceland, it was kind of nice. I don't need to have bear spray. I don't need to be concerned of any dangerous animals. So I felt even more peaceful on the hikes there. And then no bugs too, right? You're not getting eaten alive by mosquitoes like you can be here in the nature. So,
well, I went hiking in Banff.
Okay.
And also some places around Banff, but there was a lot of people there. But then we hiked beside the lake and to some small glaciers.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no one.
Yeah.
You know, that was so nice.
Yeah, lots of nice places around here. This does make me think about the documentary that you helped with, and maybe you could talk a bit about, you know, how you made that. But it is on the Icelandic Roots YouTube channel, the East Iceland Abandoned Highland Farms. And it also makes me think, you're mentioning about how you found out about a lot of these hiking trails and talking to local people. And so I was interested in watching that. Maybe what piqued your interest and what made you curious to help tell the story of these abandoned farms?
It was very strange. When I drove through there, usually I didn't look look around. I didn't like the landscape in the highland there, where the farms are. But I started to hike because of this project. I started to hike with a man who knew everything about all the abandoned farms, you know. And I just fell in love with this area. And at some places, they're so beautiful, but you can't see it from the road, you know. Yeah, I wanted to tell people about this and started to do this documentary film, but it's not a hardcore documentary film because then it would have to be 10 hours or something. So many stories and all which I had to cut.
I see. Yeah.
So we started with, I started with this man, and then he got sick, and he and his brother helped me to finish it.
Okay.
I think it's very interesting. And also because of when Askja eruption was, 1875, then many people moved to America from these farms. That's why I wanted to show it in Canada and USA. You know?
Right, right.
So, and I think it's very interesting. If I had been younger, I would have established some tourist guide to take people to these farms, you know. People that had relatives there.
Right, are descended from people that lived in those farms. Yeah. That would be very, very interesting. And it's kind of cool how you talked about, like, when you go to these areas, if you don't know the story, it's just a little bit of, old, abandoned areas.
Yeah, there are no houses. It's just ruins, you know. Mm-hmm. There's one house which was rebuilt in at one of these farms. Its name is Sænudasel, and they have a restaurant there. It's very, if you go there, go to Ísland again, you should go there.
I was so surprised, though, how, you know, these farms, a lot of them were abandoned, like, I don't know, not too long ago, maybe 100 years or so, yeah. Right? And it's so interesting how they just become so hidden, right? The grasses kind of grow over the ruins, and they look like if I walked into some of those places, I would maybe think those were from Viking times.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They left the last farm 1946. It's not such a long time. And I know there's one man alive now who is born in this farm, where the restaurant is.
And okay.
And he was in my film.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see that and to feel that real connection. It makes you feel like history, you know, is still living, and that we're really not that far away from these time periods. And it's interesting to learn about the struggles that caused people to abandon these places. But even when they were living there, just from the stories, you know, it wasn't necessarily an easy life to begin with, right?
It was a way to be independent, you know. You couldn't get married. You couldn't get married if you didn't have a land to live on. So, and all the land down in the valleys and all they were occupied, you know. So that's why they started to build up old. Sometimes there had been some places, I don't remember what they call it in English, where they went with the sheep and stayed there during the summer. There were little small houses there sometimes, but not everywhere, you know. And it was a hard life, very hard, a lot of snow. And but they had a lot of trout in the water, lakes. There are many lakes on this area.
Yeah. So lots of at least some lake trout to have some food.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And nowadays, you know, everything can be connected by roads and cars and that sort of thing. Yeah. But I couldn't imagine living back in those days where, you know, you're kind of so out in the middle of nowhere, and how difficult it would be to go to other communities for trading.
Yeah.
And these sorts of things.
Yeah, it was from one farm to Vopnafjörður, it was maybe 70, 80 kilometers you had to walk.
Mm-hmm.
Or go by horse.
Yeah, that's real hiking.
Yeah.
Hardcore hiking.
Yes.
Could you talk maybe a bit about Seyðisfjörður? I thought that was also a very beautiful area. And we did the plaque ceremony there. Icelandic Roots donated the plaque that was unveiled there. And that was an interesting place. Also where the ferry comes from, yeah. from Denmark.
Yeah, from Faroe Islands and Denmark. Yeah, Seyðisfjörður used to be the biggest place in Iceland in the old days,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I don't know why. Maybe because it was a good harbor there.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a difficult life to live in Seyðisfjörður now, because now I think they couldn't go away for 5 days, and again now it's the third day they cannot drive from Seyðisfjörður.
Okay, yeah.
Today it's a bad weather, but there's a plan to make some tunnels to Seyðisfjörður. But a lot of people from the Highland farms and from the area here around, they sailed from Seyðisfjörður. I don't remember I think they were 2,600 people that went from Seyðisfjörður. I hope I have the right amount. So there were a lot of people that sailed from Seyðisfjörður to the West, to America. Yeah.
Yeah, it did strike me kind of interesting that there's, I guess, really only the one main road to get there, where you go over this, huge mountain pass, which you would take from Egilsstaðir all the way up and over to Seyðisfjörður. And that, again, even in the modern era, I thought, wow, this could be a little bit, like you say, if the weather is not good and if the road has to close. So making tunnels, that would make a lot of sense.
I hope they will do it soon. Yeah. So people in Seyðisfjörður are special. There's a very mixed, many foreigners live there, and artist people and very nice people live there.
Yeah, it was very wonderful to visit there. I thought both places too. I really liked Egilsstaðir. It was really quite nice. And I guess a little bit different too. Most of the places, at least the larger towns that I was used to, were like Seyðisfjörður and either in a fjord or on the coast. Whereas Egilsstaðir, you do have the, I guess, quite a large lake there and the river that flows into it.
We have the river, but we have no harbor or nothing like that. So we are in inland. It is 25 kilometers to Seyðisfjörður. It's not a long way, but it's a difficult way.
Yes, high over the mountain.
Yeah, and it's around 30 kilometers to Reyðarfjörður, which is also a harbor there. So, yeah, Eyrstaðir is rather special. It's like Selfoss, you know, no sea. Yeah,
and speaking of, I guess, the lake there, and then nearby was the Vok Baths.
Yes.
Yeah, we went to that on the trip, and that was very fun. And I have to commend you for going into the cold water from the baths. I think we went in like 3 or 4 times.
I always do that. I like it. It's very good to hot cold. It's very good for me. And I love this place. I go there twice a week, usually. We have a year pass, you know. Yeah. It's very nice. And Bittin, do you like the Wilderness Center?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Yeah,
the Wilderness Center. Yeah, it was a
Wilderness, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was a very cool display there. And
I would like you to tell how you felt it.
Okay. Where was it again? It was kind of like in this big valley along the river.
Yeah, it's the last farm in this valley. There's no road further.
Yes, yes. So I guess in that regard, it felt very isolated in kind of a cool way, like you're talking about, you know, when you're the only person in a hiking trail. It gave me that kind of feeling, like it was really cool in that regard. So the landscape was very nice, but the exhibit was really cool as well. And telling the story of, well, I guess of the people there, but through the lens of how they interact with nature.
Yes, and they had also stories from elsewhere in Iceland, you know. Mm-hmm. They had one place where they tell about people that were in the highland, in the middle of the land, not in the east, where a lot of men died in bad weather. And also all kinds of stories of people in the wilderness, not just only in the east, you know. And it was so, I think it's so nice. It's so well done, you know.
Yeah, it was really quite surprising because, again, kind of in the middle of nowhere, but the exhibit was very modern and you have the audio guide and lots of cool artwork and visuals. It was really, really, honestly, probably one of the top museum experiences I've had in all of Iceland. You know, it's really right up there with places like the Settlement Center and that sort of thing.
I always say there are three things. It's a must do in this area. If you're not hiking, I'm not talking about hiking now. it's a wilderness center.
Mm-hmm.
It's Skriðuklaustur. We went there in the old house when we went to a restaurant with a,
okay.
Do you remember? With a mm-hmm. lot to eat, very good food, and work bus. This is the three places you must see near Egilsstaðir.
I wouldn't disagree. Those were all wonderful places. And then kind of all throughout this area, I'm still kind of confused where exact boundaries are, but you have this big forested area, which is Hallormsstaðir
Skógur?
Hallormsstaðir, yeah. Yes, that one.
Yeah, it's the biggest forest in Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
And I live 7 kilometers from them. And we went to this church. Old country church. It's one of my favorite places also.
Oh, that's right. When we had to drive through the trees and get down there. Yes, yes.
Yeah. My daughter was baptized there. So
things were just so picturesque in those areas. Yeah, and I certainly did notice just more trees in general. It was a kind of a different forested feel in those areas too.
Yeah, it's also growing trees, you know, in this area. Like in my farm, there is a lot of trees in my farm.
Hmm.
And you get the state gives you some money to do it, you know.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so really encouraging
the
reforesting of these areas. But I understand a lot of it, too, was already, you know, natural forests that hadn't yet been cut down, and they've just kind of expanded because people were planting more and more and then leaving them to grow, right? I think a lot of these areas don't regenerate if it turns into grazing areas, right? And the sheep are always eating the little buds, so you have to kind of manage it so there's not sheep eating all of the
Yeah, when the trees are little, it's mm-hmm. okay to let sheep go in the forest when the trees are big, no. But there's not a lot of sheep here anymore.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point too. It was less sheep in those areas than elsewhere in Iceland.
Yeah.
And why do you think that is? Just had there been more in the past, and people are just less farming sheep?
I think it's everywhere there. Young people don't want to be farmers.
Mm.
I think that's the main reason. And then some people, there's not a lot of money for the meat, you know. You don't get high salary if you are a farmer. So that's why they change maybe from sheep to trees and then to tourists. There are many, many places where they have accommodations.
From sheep to trees to tourists. Yeah, I think in some ways, though, like some of the tourism and, you know, you can have that extra income from a farm by having a guest house or an Airbnb. I think in some ways that has maybe helped some of the farmers. I know around rural Alberta or Saskatchewan and the prairie provinces and states too, if you aren't making money from your farming practices, then they don't really have any other options. Whereas at least in Iceland, even in some of the most isolated places, you can still at least attract some people that need a guest house to stay in.
Yeah.
And I find a lot of Icelanders are more like yourself and have lots of different interests. So maybe they're doing something with the hiking guide or, you know, again, the guest houses or even like different museum and tour things. So I find a lot of creativity there that is not often the case with farmers in these rural places in North America.
Like my son, he bought a farm and made the cow house to dog houses, you know. Yeah, so they have no animals except dogs. I have Icelandic horses here. I can see them through my window, but I don't own them. They just come here for grass. Usually there's not much snow here during winter. It's more snow in Eyrstad, you know, than here. So that's good to have horses.
And I imagine now too, it's a beginning of April. So how are the days getting much longer? And I'm sure more sunlight is very nice now.
Yeah. They're getting, you know, the longest day is in June. So and the shortest day is in December. So we are on the way.
Kind of halfway in between.
Yeah.
I want to just backtrack a bit and talk more about the abandoned farms, and maybe to ask you why. Well, you talked about, you know, how you kind of got interested in them, but I know that a lot of times
now they're barking. Can I call
for the dogs? Okay, yes, no problem.
He wanted to come up, this one. He calls me.
What's his name?
Moke. He's from Canada.
Oh, okay.
I imported him from Canada.
He's an immigrant.
Yeah. Yes. I'm sorry. But again. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just trying to, I guess, impress upon the fact that you're interested in these stories of those who left these farms and immigrated to North America. And from what I understand, oftentimes those stories are not totally well known. And the people who've left Iceland, unless someone was directly related to these families, it's not always a history that people are always very interested in. So how did you find that process? And do you yourself have relatives that immigrated to Canada during those times?
Yeah, I have some relatives, but no one very close, you know. But it was my interest came with these farms. I think it has been very difficult to for the people to, because they had no place to go after the eruption, you know. And the farm, you couldn't live on the farms. Some got rebuilt after that, and some of them didn't have any ash. It depended where the farms were. When there were most people there, there were around 100 people that lived there on this farm, on 16 farms. And it was a very nice community. It was a people that, not just poor people that, you know, everyone could write and read, and they were making poems and all that. There was a lot of things going on. They taught them children themselves in the beginning, but later there was like a school down in the valley, you know. They went to the school there. Yeah, so I think it's so interesting. Like this old man I was talking about, who was born in Sænadalsá. That's why I started to think about it. His grandfather, he moved to Canada. I don't remember what the year, around 1900, I think. Or maybe 1890 or so. No, around 1900. And he left one boy behind, because he had him with another woman, you know. So these people, they have a lot of relatives out there, and the daughter of this man, she's a friend of mine, and she has been visiting her great grandfather's grave, you know, in Canada. So I would love more people to come to visit this old farms with me.
Yeah, there is certainly a lot of connections. Not myself. My family was more in the west and north, but I know a lot of us with Icelandic roots do trace our ancestry to eastern areas. And again, taking that route, as you were mentioning, taking the ships from Seyðisfjörður.
Yeah, and Vopnafjörður, of course. Some of the people on them, these farms went to Vopnafjörður first and waited for the ship.
Yeah, it would have been, as you said, just a difficult time and interesting to imagine. But then, as you said as well, a lot of these families were, of course, very well educated, and they seemed to have this thirst for knowledge and, you know, self-educating themselves or going to school, and just a lot of potential. But if, you know, if there's not much going on in the community, if the farming isn't good, if they're struggling to get by, then what do you do with that, right? And so I could imagine if they got a pamphlet advertising North America and these sorts of areas, that would be so interesting.
But some people in the East, they thought they didn't like people to go to America.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, Kathy tells me that some of them thought they were traitors.
Yeah.
Leave the old country. But it's not like that today.
How has the response been since making this documentary? Have you had local people reach out maybe with more stories?
Yeah, local people here.
Mm-hmm.
Not with stories from these farms, because I got a lot of stories, but I couldn't use
them
all.
Well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But people are very interested in welcoming Western Iceland, mm-hmm. Icelanders to here. And I went last summer, there came people here, and I went to one farm, not a Highland farm, but I knew the people, so I said, okay, yes, I will go with you. And we went to Áskirkja also, Mm-hmm. Where we the church, mm-hmm. because her great grandmother had got married there.
Mm.
So
wow.
There's a lot of possibilities to do something nice. Mm-hmm. And I'm welcoming two families next year, which I'm going to take to some Highland farms, one of them, and another farm, one of them.
Hmm. So why?
It's just.
Why do you like?
It's just a hobby. It's just a hobby, you know.
Yes. Okay. But what is there something maybe deeper? Like why do you care to do this? I mean, I could imagine it's so wonderful, and I know from my perspective, connecting with people in Iceland that are either relatives or that are just everyone's somehow related, which we can all see through genealogy. But yeah, what is special about this for you?
I'm so interested in these old farms, especially these Highland farms, and I love to show people where their ancestors lived. And I think it must be very wonderful for them to come to the places. I know that in this box, which is with at each farm, there's a guest book, and people write in it. And at one place, there was someone who was visiting, and he said, "Oh my God, my grandfather lived here," and all, you know. So I think it's so. I like to tell people and show people also by both the Highland farms and also beautiful places. I like to. I've been a group leader in hiking tours abroad many years, and I've been on the top of Kilimanjaro, for example.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm still doing a little
bit. Wow.
My
okay.
brother used to have a travel agency, and I could make some hiking tours. I wanted to go, and we sold people that.
Well, it just seems to be something special about those sorts of connections. It's kind of different things, right? Nature, people, history, and all of those things. When you can combine them, it just seems to be a very special human thing that I think anyone feels good in being involved with.
Yes, I think so.
Could you talk quickly about Mount Kilimanjaro? That's a really cool experience.
Yeah. Well, it's not a difficult mountain, except for the high sickness.
Yes, right, and the altitude.
Yeah. And we were 16 people, Icelanders, that went there. And my son was also there. And the two youngest people didn't make it. So I think it's because you have more muscles. And,
yeah, right.
And muscles take oxygen, you know. But it was a very exciting tour, and I loved. I'm very pleased to have gone there, and but also we went safari afterwards, and I loved that. Yeah. So I've been in Nepal also hiking.
Okay.
In the Himalayas and in Peru, the Inca Road. I started to live after 50. I started to do interesting thing after 50.
Yeah, well, the world's also opened up so much in the last, few decades or so, right? It's just become so much more easy to travel the world and to experience other places like that.
I love traveling, but I also love being here in the all alone with the dogs at my home.
Yeah, there's a good balance to life. It's important to have a nice home and people and animals that you love and that you are comfortable with. But then I think it's very important to experience these other places and other cultures.
Yes.
Hjördís, this has been really fantastic chatting with you. Is there anything else you would like to say, or any other stories that have come to mind that you would like to share before we wrap up?
I don't think so. I don't remember anything. But
Well, this has been great to chat, and you're truly a wealth of knowledge. So I really thank you for, first of all, for everything that you've done with Icelandic Roots and with sharing these stories of history and of nature. And it's been really wonderful to have spent time with you as well in person during the tour. And I hope to be able to see you again in the future, and hope maybe some people listening to this will come and visit you and visit some of their relatives' Highland farms.
Yes, I would love that. And you are always welcome, Jack, if you are in the East.
Yes, well, maybe for next trip,
yeah,
we'll have to go to the East.
Yes.